Hello, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts, we explore different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Now, in today's podcast, Declan in the library and myself thought we'd do a slight change of tact. Instead of focusing on a particular key event of 100 years ago, we instead thought we would talk about the life of one important individual from that era, that person being Peter Dolucri. His name crops up an awful lot in these podcasts, and it would be nice to take a look at the man himself and see what he was about. Indeed, the revolutionary era in Kilkenny could not be talked about without mentioning his name. He was the most public face of the Irish freedom movement of the revolutionary decade, right from the very beginning and through to the very end and beyond. Now, I should say that I am not the expert on Peter Dolucri. That honour goes to Declan Dunn, who wrote a brilliant biography about him entitled Peter's Keys. That book is available in local bookshops still, and of course is available in the local libraries around Kilkenny. The author Declan also happens to be Peter's grandson, which adds an extra perspective to the book, especially as he had access to the family papers held by the late Padraigín Ní Dubhlacra, the great teacher and Irish scholar that people in Kilkenny would have known. I'm sorry if I made a hames of pronouncing that name. Now, just to give some examples of the many different hats Peter Dolucri wore. He was IRB head centre in Kilkenny from the early 1900s. It should be said this was prior to the independence movement becoming mainstream and widely accepted. Then it was very much a small niche or clique. As we will see, he was imprisoned after 1916. He afterwards became leader of the Sinn Féin political organisation in Kilkenny. He was also elected to the Kilkenny County and Borough Councils. He served six consecutive terms as Mayor of Kilkenny, a record that had gone back since the city status was bestowed on Kilkenny back in 1609. He was imprisoned during the fake German plot arrests of 1918 and famously helped Eamon de Valera escape from prison in 1919. For a brief period during the War of Independence, he became commander of the Kilkenny IRA. Then, taking the pro-treaty side, he initially helped broker the peace between the two sides in Kilkenny in early 1922, initially avoiding a civil war outbreak. Also, in 1922, he had the honour of being appointed to the very first Irish Senate. He later became a Cumnanaill TD for the constituency. Phew, that is a lot of living in the space of his 20 years of public life. He married the love of his life, Winnie Murphy, in the middle of all that as well, and it was her that kept the home fires burning, along with helping to keep the family businesses run when Peter was away, sometimes of course on enforced leave in an English prison. She was also president of the local Cumann na mBan organisation upon its foundation in the county in 1916. I think Declan Dunn actually encapsulates his grandfather's jam-packed life best in one sentence when he said, quote, Peter Dolucri was at various times an inventor, an actor, a judge, IRA brigadier, fireman, cinema and theatre owner, industrial relations mediator, iron founder, engineer, locksmith, manager of a bomb factory, and politician, end quote. So to go back to the very beginning, Peter Dolucri was born on the 22nd of April, 1882, the fourth son of Richard and Bridget Dolucri, and into the family iron foundry business that was based in Rote House, Kilkenny. As you probably know, Rote House is now a restored historic tourist attraction, but at the time it was divided into tenements with businesses running from the front and the side of the building. It certainly wasn't luxury or an ideal place to be raising a young family. His father did well in business though, and the family later moved a few doors up to 18 Parliament Street, where Peter spent most of his life afterwards. Peter's father, that's Richard, wasn't an original Fenian or IRB man. He had been around when Kilkenny man James Stevens founded the organisation in the 1860s. Richard had also spent time in the US, where he was part of the sister Fenian group over there called Clan na n-Éill. So it's safe to say that Peter was born into a strongly Fenian family. His father, Richard, just like his son afterwards, was not afraid to stand out or put his head above the parapet. The fact he had travelled beyond the shores of Ireland also possibly broadened his horizons. As an 8-year-old, Peter witnessed a vitriolic by-election that was held for the House of Commons North Kilkenny seat in 1890. the candidates were split into pro and anti Charles Stuart Parnell factions. Peter's father was strongly in support of the Parnell side and spoke at the rallies in favour of that candidate, Vincent Scully. Again, this was not the popular thing, as most of the clergy were scandalised by Parnell and his recent involvement in divorce proceedings. This was indeed a brave stance to take, and there were many stories of Kilkenny families falling out over that memorable election. In the end, the anti-Parnell candidate won the election, with Richard's Parnell supporting candidates outnumbering the votes 2-1. Now, when Peter was 12 in 1894, his father sadly died of kidney failure at the young age of just 51. His mother also died at the age of 51 some years later in 1901. So sadly, he was now orphaned while still in his teens. But it's safe to say he had certainly been inspired and influenced by both of his parents. He then took over the foundry business with his brother John and also became an active member of the recently founded Kilkenny Gaelic League Club in his spare time. Of course, during this period, the speaking or learning of the Irish language was banned from the local primary schools, so Peter would not have had the opportunity to learn it. But he wholeheartedly joined in, and this was another way he could stamp his Irishness on his personality. Alongside his brothers, the Gaelic League and the Kilkenny Theatre Group also introduced them to acting, and Peter very much enjoyed treading the boards. Around this period, in the first decade of the 1900s, he also revitalised the local IRB Fenians group, also known as an IRB Circle. This was an organisation that his father had been a proud member of. Peter became head centre of the Kilkenny group while still in his early 20s. Now, this was a very small group of men in Kilkenny. The ultimate aim of the IRB was total Irish freedom or separation from Britain. But in a more practical or day-to-day way in Kilkenny, they organised advanced nationalist events, such as the annual commemoration to the Manchester Martyrs, who were, of course, a group of Irish prisoners executed in the 1860s in England. That annual commemoration event was something his father had organised previously when he was alive, so he was kind of following in his father's footsteps. The IRB also protested against the King's visit to Kilkenny in 1904 and hung black flags around the Sisian protest. It was in the IRB that Peter cemented his relationships with his lifelong friends, most notably Tom Stallard, Jim Lawler and Pat Corcoran. The four men would go on to play pivotal roles in various guises during the revolutionary decade that followed in Kilkenny. Peter also became friendly, if that is the correct word, with E.T. Keane, proprietor of the Kilkenny People newspaper. This newspaper was seen as the most controversial and radical newspaper in Kilkenny at the time. It had, of course, been founded in support of the pro-Parnellised element. Kerryman E.T. Keane would go on to support much of the Sinn Féin ideals throughout the following decades. Although from time to time Peter and himself were prone to clashing, they were both strong-willed and independent-minded men, but they did have a deep respect for each other, even if it always wasn't visible on the outside. Peter was a committee member of the very first iteration of the Sinn Féin Club set up in Kilkenny in 1907. Initially, it wasn't a mainstream political organisation. Instead, it was basically a boy Irish group based on the ideals and ideas of Arthur Griffiths that, in a nutshell, encouraged Irish consumers to support Irish businesses by buying only Irish-made produce. So, in other words, just promoting Ireland's economic independence from Britain. I suppose a kind of guaranteed Irish stamp of its day. In 1911, Peter stood for the local council elections and won a seat. He was by this stage very well known, of course, especially in business, theatre, GA and of course IRB circles, so it wasn't really a surprise. The Delucres had a long lineage in Kilkenny, so that rather unusual family surname was well known too and no doubt would have played a part as well. 1911 was indeed a momentous year for Peter, besides his election. Just a few days after his 29th birthday, he married local girl Winnie Murphy in St. Patrick's Church in Kilkenny City. It was indeed an apt venue for the nuptials, as he had met Winnie while singing in the choir there. Peter also met many of the leading figures of revolutionary-era Ireland on their visits to Kilkenny over the years. The O'Rahilly was present at one of the Manchester Martyrs commemorations. He would, of course, die on the final day of the Easter Rising in Dublin, mortally wounded, charging down Moore Street. IRB leader Bulmer Hobson was also down in Kilkenny at a commemoration. Peter also met Tomás Macdonagh and Sir Roger Casement, both executed after the 1916 rebellion, when they were present at the founding of the Irish Volunteers in Kilkenny in March 1914. Sean MacDiarmida, another executed leader and pivotal to the rising, was also present in Dalucri's house a few months prior to the rising, that being in November 1915. Cathal Brew, killed during the Civil War, met Dalucri in Kilkenny in the weeks prior to the rising as well to inform him of the plans. Peter also made a speech for Countess Markievicz when she was awarded the Freedom of Kilkenny in 1917 during the city by-election that summer. Now the 1916 rising was somewhat controversial for Dalucri in later life, in that it was said that Kilkenny did not come out, and he was blamed for this as he was the head of the IRB locally. Now it must be said that this is something that happened to many of the IRB leaders around Ireland after 1916, so he was in good company. They weren't to know that 1916 would become the seminal moment of Irish history. Anyways, the plan for Kilkenny was very basic. They weren't going to take over the city or anything as dramatic as that. There was only around 30 or so men in the Irish Volunteers in Kilkenny City at the time, with of course some additional IRB men. There would have been around the same number of people up in North Kilkenny, so it would not have been very many men altogether in total and mightn't have made a huge difference. The only plan sent from Dublin was for all of them to make their way to the Carlow-Wexford border and link up with the other Irish Volunteers there. No further strategy was provided, so even if they had followed the exact plan, it's likely they would have seen little action, unless of course they had taken their own initiative, just like the Enniscorthy group. And it should be said that the Irish Volunteers in Kilkenny were always keen afterwards to point out that they did meet up every night during Easter week 1916 and were ready and willing to come out and play their role if they had proper instructions. Instead, the power struggle between the IRB factions in Dublin counted against Kilkenny taking an active role in the rising. This was mainly because Ginger O'Connell, the leader of the Irish Volunteers in the southeast, who had spent many weeks living in the Dalucri home, was against the rising. He had taken Owen McNeill's side. This was cemented further when Dalucri himself travelled to Dublin on Holy Week 1916 with his good friend from the IRB, Pat Corcoran, to hear from the horse's mouth what was happening, that mouth being Owen McNeill's. He told Dalucri not to follow any orders received from Pearse or Tom Clarke, but only if the orders came directly from him. So then it is not really difficult to understand why Peter chose to follow the orders of Ginger O'Connell, whom he had built a personal relationship with over many months, along with Owen McNeill, whom he had just only recently met on Holy Week, and he had had very little dealings with Clark or Pearse directly. It was also for this reason that Dalucri refused to hand over grenade shells, or bombs as they called them, which he had made in his foundry, to a Conamon woman when she arrived down from Dublin. She'd been sent by Tom Clark, and Dalucri sent her back empty-handed. So it's safe to assume that Peter had decided in the days prior to Easter Monday which side of the fence he was on in the Irish Volunteer / IRB split, and his loyalties laid with the man closest to him, Ginger O'Connell. He did, however, show his willingness to contribute to the fight before that rift had occurred, when he transported a large amount of guns and explosives in the weeks prior to the rising. Now, in the aftermath of the rising on Wednesday the 3rd of May 1916, just a few days after the rising had finished in Dublin, the very first arrest took place in Kilkenny. Ginger O'Connell was detained by the RSE that day. He was actually arrested in Dalucri's house. Then the very next day, Peter himself was arrested. On the same evening, the 4th of May, James Nolan, president of the GA and Kilkenny IRB member, was arrested having just arrived from Dublin. In all, a total of 33 men from Kilkenny were arrested, a relatively large number considering there was no conflict in the area. They were transported to jails in England. They were all released though by the end of July 1916, just 2 months later, and returned to heroes' welcomes. Now, in the spring of 1918, Peter was arrested in what became known as the German plot arrests. This was a fake plot invented by the Dublin Castle administration to arrest the key Sinn Féin players from all over around the country, i.e. it was said that they were conspiring with Germany, and over 80 were arrested. It was really just a case though of just round up the usual suspects to stop them from increasing any anti-World War I sentiment, and especially the anti-conscription feelings of the public that were brewing. World War I was still dragging on at this stage, and the British government was attempting to introduce conscription to Ireland to bolster the number of soldiers in the army. It backfired badly with massive protests from all angles. Anyway, Peter DeLucri ended up in an English prison once again, this time in Lincoln Jail in the east of England in the county of Lincolnshire, as of course he was seen to be the Sinn Féin figurehead in Kilkenny. It was here he had his most celebrated claim to fame. Indeed, his pivotal role in helping Eamon de Valera escape from Lincoln Prison in February 1919 made headlines all around the world and was a highly embarrassing event for the British government. There had grown an enormous amount of sympathy for the German plot prisoners by 1919, especially as by then the First World War had ended, so there did not appear to be a valid reason to keep them in jail. This was illustrated at the Kilkenny City Council meeting held on the 23rd of January 1919, when the still incarcerated Peter DeLucri was elected mayor. There was no dissenting voices in the council. But at that particular time, Peter had other things on his mind. So here is how the breakout from Lincoln Jail came about. In the end, everything would come down to Peter DeLucri's brilliant metalworking skills. He not just helped Eamon de Valera to freedom, who was then of course president of Sinn Féin, but crucial associates also got free, Sean Milroy and Sean McGarry. But initially, it was to the outside the prisoners looked for help. The plan was to make one master key, which would open all the gates and doors in the jail, so they could simply just walk out. They knew this was an option, as the priest that arrived to say Mass on Sundays had a key that opened all the doors. Now, there were a number of failed attempts of procuring a master key from the outside before Peter's talents with metal were put to good use. Remember, at this stage, Peter had no tools inside the prison. So the initial plan involved the prisoners getting the dimensions of the master key if they were to have any hope of getting a copy sent in. They would try getting the measurements from the key Canon Scott, the prison chaplain, had. Eamon de Valera had been acting as sacristan and altar server for the priest. During one of the masses, de Valera secretly made an impression of the head of the key in soft candle wax, which he placed in a tin. Now, that is slightly different than was portrayed in the Michael Collins film, but you get the gist. The prisoners now had the dimensions and the outline of the key. One of the prisoners, Sean Milroy, was a talented cartoonist, and he made drawings of the master key and corresponding keyhole using the exact dimensions gained from the wax impression in a comic Christmas-themed postcard. The idea of concocting the cartoon illustration while also using the Irish and Latin languages in the corresponding letter was to not arouse the suspicion of the prison warden, who was assisting the prisoners by posting the letter and postcard out. In other words, they couldn't just say, "Hey, will you send in a key with these dimensions," as they rightly believed the letter could be intercepted or read by the warden. To lessen suspicion even further, the letter was addressed to a priest in Leeds, Father James Kavanagh, who was originally from Munlavat, with instructions for further delivery. The cartoon illustration with the master key dimensions eventually reached Michael Collins, who understood the significance of the drawing immediately. He had a key made and sent into Lincoln Jail baked in a cake. Now, in the meantime, the prisoners had become despondent over the Christmas and New Year period, as they thought their clever ploy regarding the cartoon had not been understood. But eventually, in early January 1919, a cake arrived for the prisoners. They were ecstatic to find a key inside. However, their joy soon turned to disappointment when the key broke in the keyhole on its very first use. For the second attempt, Sean Milroy created another clandestine cartoon. However, Father Kavanagh either lost this letter or perhaps, having become uncomfortable acting as a facilitator of a jailbreak, destroyed the communication. Eventually, another letter was smuggled out with the help of an ill prisoner who was being transferred to hospital. Another cake was delivered with two keys inside this time, with a date also fixed for the planned escape. So this shows, besides actually getting a key in, the other vital factor in any potential escape was the conveying of the precise information to Michael Collins as to the date and time of the planned breakout. The three would-be escapees would only have a maximum of a few hours before they were missed by wardens. Similarly, other factors, such as when there was an unhelpful full moon, would also have to be factored into any getaway plans. However, unfortunately for the prisoners, frustratingly, none of these keys worked either. It was likely the hot wax used for the key imprint shrunk when softened, so the copies weren't actually to the exact dimensions. Now, on the 24th of January 1919, for a third attempt in obtaining a key, and to let Collins know that the most recent key had not worked, the prisoner sent a message stating they would like the customary present to celebrate Peter de Lucre's election as mayor of Kilkenny the previous day. They suggested the customary present, cryptically referring to a cake with a key, be sent in. On this third occasion, Harry Boland himself, Michael Collins' right-hand man, delivered the cake personally, even though he was a wanted man at the time. Once again, though, the two keys inside did not work. You would be thinking they were losing all hope. But finally, at the fourth attempt, there was success. And it was here that Peter de Lucre's expertise, honed in the foundry over many years, was the decisive factor. The cake this time contained blank keys, along with metal files. So instead of a completed key going in, they would put everything in the hands of de Lucre to fashion a key himself while inside the prison. Now, so as not to arouse suspicion, the cake was addressed to Mayor de Lucre with congratulations and best wishes from a few Kilkenny exiles. Signed, J. Dardis. De Lucre then got to work in shaping the blank keys into usable keys. He even took the cell lock out of his own door one afternoon to aid him and placed it back before lockup and before anyone noticed. After a number of days of working as noiselessly as possible, he created a near-perfect key with just the files and two stout penknives as his tools. To the delight of all internees, the key opened the doors beautifully. Then, on the night of the 3rd of February 1919, De Valera, Milroy and McGarry escaped from Lincoln Prison by simply walking out under the cover of darkness. Michael Collins and Harry Boland were waiting on the other side of the prison wall and ferried the men to safe houses and, of course, to freedom. Now, whether Dev put on a woman's coat is subject to debate. It was over 3 hours before the warders missed him, and so they got a good head start. De Valera's escape made worldwide headlines, and he became a real-life Scarlet Pimpernel, with supposed sightings of him simultaneously in different continents, would you believe? The new mayor of Kilkenny could be satisfied with his role, or should I say key role, in making all this happen. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Now, just 6 weeks after the escape, the German plot prisoners were released by the British authorities in a general amnesty. After 10 months of confinement, Peter returned to Kilkenny in March 1919. He was met by Wayne at the train station. A large crowd gathered on the parade to welcome him home and to witness his formal investiture as Mayor of Kilkenny by Alderman James Nolan, who said, "I have the greatest possible pleasure in putting on de Lucre, the felon, the mayoral chain of the city of Kilkenny." The following year, in 1920, Peter was re-elected again in the local elections. He also acted as a judge on the Sinn Féin courts that were established at this time. Now, it should be said that during Peter's era, the council had much more wide-ranging powers than even would be the case today. For example, the council looked after all the medical needs of the city, and Peter was on the board of both the county hospital, or the workhouse hospital as it was known then, and also the local mental asylum as it was called then. So he was fully au fait with the day-to-day management of these institutions, and indeed the medical requirements of the patients. This was because the council taxes directly funded these institutions, and value for money was a big thing. Of course, his attitudes would have reflected those of wider society at the time, those not considered the deserving poor, such as alcoholics or women who gave birth outside of marriage, for instance, were sometimes given short shrift. And there was one area where he did make enemies, that being with the local trade unions. Indicative of many business owners of that time, he was wary of the power of unions and not supportive of many of the strikes that took place in Kilkenny, although he did often try to facilitate a resolution. This sometimes caused tensions with the local Labour Party, who Sinn Féin were nominally in coalition with on the council after 1920. During one bitter strike which involved the Corporation Council workers and separately the miners in Castlecomer, William O'Brien, who was a Dublin City councillor and ITGWU member, addressed a meeting on the parade in Kilkenny and said the following, quote, "The Mayor of Kilkenny, Peter de Lucre, swore allegiance to his national government, the Dáil, and he was the first man in Ireland to repudiate that allegiance when it was a question of paying a few cents more to the poor unfortunate labourers of Kilkenny. Kilkenny Corporation is composed principally of shopkeepers, butchers, and as many more robbers as could be found. It is up to the workers of Kilkenny to make up their minds whether they were going to be slaves or not." End quote. During the War of Independence years of 1920 and 21, the Lucrees' home life and businesses suffered as the family were constantly raided by Crown forces. In addition, he had to close his car hire business as the authorities refused to grant him licenses. Now, he did not play an active role as such in the military side of the War of Independence, although he was actually elected IRA Brigade Commander for County Kilkenny in November 1920 following the arrest of Tom Tracy. His appointment lasted less than 3 weeks as he was arrested then in December 1920 by the dreaded auxiliaries and brought to Woodstock House in Inishteig. This occurred after Ernie O'Malley's papers were captured in a raid there. Of course, Peter's name featured prominently in them. While imprisoned at Woodstock, Peter was used as a hostage in their frequent raids. To elaborate, he was placed in the front of their trucks to avoid them being ambushed, as if shooting broke out, he would likely be the first to be shot. He, along with O'Malley and others, were then transferred to Arbor Hill Barracks before Christmas 1920, and they spent Christmas and the New Year there. Peter was released unconditionally on the 21st of January 1921, having previously refused to sign a document denouncing the IRA. He didn't have much peace at home, however, as a few weeks later the house was raided again, as the local police were now keen to arrest him once more. So he had to spend the final 5 months of the War of Independence in early 1921 on the run. He did return some days and some nights to the family home and also stayed in Tom Stallard's house. And for a period for his own safety and to recover his health a bit, he also spent some time at his sister Lil's house in Dublin. After the treaty was agreed in London at the end of 1921, De Lucrey became a strong pro-treaty voice in Kilkenny. He said the, quote, document to which Arthur Griffith, Michael Collins and their fellow plenipotentiaries fixed their signatures would receive the endorsement of the Irish people and the Irish race, end quote. And he also believed that the negotiators accomplished a miracle in bringing back a really good deal. At a party in March 1922 to celebrate the handover of Kilkenny military barracks to the Free States authorities, Mayor De Lucrey summed up the swiftness of the changes taking place in Ireland, saying, I do not think that any of us a few short months ago ever thought, not even in our wildest dreams, that Irish soldiers would so soon occupy Kilkenny military barracks, end quote. Before and after the Battle of Kilkenny in May 1922, which was a precursor to the Civil War, Peter tried to act as a peace broker and mediate between the two sides. Also during this period, his wife Winnie became president of the new Cumann na Saoirse female organisation after the split in Cumann na Mban caused by the treaty. This organisation received the unflattering nickname of Cumann na Searchers from their former comrades in Cumann na Mban, as some of the women helped the Free States Army in their searches. Then in August 1922, in his capacity as Mayor of Kilkenny, he attended the funerals of both Arthur Griffith, a friend since 1917, and then Michael Collins just 2 weeks later. Both funerals were held in St Mary's Pro-Cathedral in Dublin. In addition to him serving six consecutive terms as Mayor of Kilkenny between 1919 and 1926, Peter was also appointed to the first Senate of the Irish Free State in December 1922. Now, he was in very good company there. Some other senators included W.B. Yeats, Douglas Hyde, and his old friend from his Kilkenny Gaelic League days, Lady Dysart, also invested as a new senator. It should be noted that being a senator at this time was a very dangerous thing to do, as the anti-treaty IRA had threatened to kill or at least destroy the homes of members of the new Oireachtas. Over 35 senators actually lost their homes or properties at this time. Towards the tail end of the Civil War in April 1923, Mayor and then Senator Peter De Lucrey presided over the formal establishment of a local branch of Cumann na n-Éill, the new political party. De Lucrey stated the aim of his new party was to uphold the treaty. The party mostly comprised of the pro-treaty Sinn Féin TDs who were elected the year previously and would later join smaller parties in creating Fine Gael in the 1930s. De Lucrey became a Cumann na n-Éill TD a few years later in 1927. Now, he did contribute to numerous debates, perhaps most notably in regards to censorship of the cinema, a subject close to his heart as he ran a cinema with his friend Tom Stallard in Kilkenny. He did not want over-censorship and indeed had clashed with the local clergy on another occasion in regards to having all cinemas closed on Sundays. Now, just going back to 1919, before De Valera had escaped from Lincoln Prison, De Lucrey had made him promise to return his handiwork, i.e. the key, sometime in the future. However, Harry Boland had a key in his possession after the jailbreak, and after he was killed in 1922, the family were not too inclined to part with it. Having met De Valera in the Dáil Éireann restaurant in 1929, De Luchry once again demanded the key to be returned to him and for De Valera to keep his promise. De Valera obviously put some of the Civil War animosities aside for a time, as after much work, he obtained the key from the Boland family and handed it to De Luchry in Leinster House 10 years after his escape. So much had changed in the intervening years since the two men were in prison together. But Peter De Luchry would not have much time to admire his creation, as in 1931 he began suffering from kidney failure, just as his father did 40 years before. He died at his sister Lil's home in Dublin on the 23rd of October 1931, with his beloved Wynne by his side. He was aged just 49 years old, 2 years younger than his father and mother when they had died. Although they had just been married for 20 years, Wynne and Peter had had 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls, namely Dick, Tom, Lily, Sheila, Nessa and Padder Og. Winnie De Luchry actually lived for another 35 years after her husband's death. She passed away at the age of 78 on the 16th of April 1966, coincidentally Easter week on the 50th anniversary of the Rising, where her late husband had played such a prominent role in Kilkenny. I think you'll agree that Peter, and indeed his wife Winnie, certainly packed an awful lot into their lives. And I think that is where we leave it for today. Just thank you all once again for listening, and don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.